This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Graham Nash first came to the United States as part of the British invasion with his band The Hollies. But he later helped define California's Laurel Canyon sound, singing harmonies as part of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Both groups have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Hollies got started at the same time as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and shared the stage with each of those bands in England. Nash left the Hollies in 1968 to sing with Stephen Stills and David Crosby. They were joined by Neil Young in 1969. Some of their most famous songs were written by Nash, including Our House, Teacher Children, and Marrakesh Express. Graham Nash has just written a memoir called Wild Tales, A Rock and Roll Life. Before we hear Terry's interview with Graham Nash, let's listen to the Hollies' 1966 hit Bus Stop.
Graham Nash, welcome back to Fresh Air. I think this was maybe the first Hollies big hit in the United States. And there's actually a fun story behind how you recorded the song. Would you tell it?
Yes. We had a manager called Michael Cohen, and he owned a tailor shop in Stockport in the north of England that I actually worked at one point. And he came to us one day and he said, you know, this neighborhood, this woman keeps driving me crazy. She says she has this son who writes songs. Would you do me a favor? Go and, you know, pat him on the head and encourage him and get her off my back, basically. So we go down to this house. There's a 14, 15-year-old kid there, and he's got a guitar. And we were the Hollies. We'd had a couple of hits, and we were, you know, full of ourselves. And we said, okay, kid, what have you got? He picks up his guitar, and he goes, bus stop, wet day, she's there, I say. We knew immediately that we could make a great record of that. So we said, okay, well, yeah, great, we'll take that song, and we get up to leave. And then one of us said, have you got anything else? He said, yeah, I have this song, and it goes like this, look through any window, yeah. So that was two that we wanted. And we said, okay, one last time, anything else? He said, I wrote this song this morning for my friend Peter Noon, who's singing with this new band, Herman's Hermits, and it goes, no milk today, my love has gone away. This young kid had written three fantastic pop songs. That was a very interesting moment in our lives.
Yeah, so you got your hands on Bus Stop. Do you want to say anything about the harmonies on this?
Basically based on me and Alan singing strong two-part like the Everly Brothers, Tony adding his third part, we cut Bus Stop, I think it was an hour and 50 minutes. It was an incredibly fast experience. And I think that's my favorite Holly song is Bus Stop.
Yeah, I think it's mine too. I think one of the things that really is so great about it is the minor key.
Yeah, Graham Gouldman, who of course wrote Bus Stop and Look Through Any Window and No Milk Today and For Your Love, etc., and formed a great band, 10cc, a few years later. And as a matter of fact, I was in contact with Graham just this week. His name has been entered for consideration for the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I happen to know the president, and I'm going to encourage him to
you're pulling some strings.
Yes. Why not?
Why not?
Because he wrote great songs. Why not?
You met the Hollies co-founder, Alan Clark, when you were kids. Were you 6 years old or something?
6 years old, yes. I remember it to this day, that moment. It was a very interesting point in my life.
What happened?
He was brought into the classroom by his grandmother, and Mr. Burke, who was our teacher, said, "Okay, well, Harold Clark is here. He's moving from Broughton, so where's he going to sit?" And the only vacant seat at that time was next to me. How fortuitous.
So one of the things you did was to sing the Lord's Prayer together in harmony when you were in grade school?
Yeah, and we did that completely naturally, and I have no idea why. And I can't ever remember talking to Alan about which part to take. It was just a completely natural thing that we did. And then we did minstrel shows, and we sang at parties, and we always had this musical connection. I'm at a loss to explain what that was, but it was just very real in our lives. And we loved to sing ever since then. And the Holly sound was basically based on me and Alan singing good two-part. And then later Tony Hicks, who was the lead guitar player, came in to sing the third harmony. But it was basically based on me and Alan.
When you say you did minstrel shows, what do you mean by minstrel shows?
Well, actually, you know, and it's terribly un-PC, Terry, but we would put on blackface.
No, really?
Absolutely.
No.
I'm not kidding. Terrible to think of, but, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, it wasn't so unusual.
Wow. So what did you sing when you put on blackface? I mean, you didn't do Al Jolson songs, probably.
Absolutely.
I mean, you did?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Al Jolson was kind of a hero of mine. I mean, I know that when you look at it, you know, in retrospect, it was a little weird, but he was a great performer and a great singer.
So what songs were these?
Oh,
Swanee, you know, River? I mean,
yeah, all the Mammy, you know, all those.
Oh, gosh.
All those, yes. It's a terrible thing to admit, but that's the truth.
That is so weird because, you know, at the same time, I'm sure, like, you're really admiring all the rhythm and blues that's coming out of the United States, and you're singing Mammy in blackface. That's so odd.
I know, yes. So life is so strange, isn't it, Tim?
Well, let's move ahead. At some point, you started to feel distant from the Hollies.
I did.
And you're right, part of the reason was that when you started smoking marijuana, it had a profound effect on you. You write, "It jolted my curiosity onto an entirely higher plane. The Hollies, on the other hand, were strictly pub guys. They had their 8 pints a night to get their jollies. I felt like we were starting to drift apart."
So that's true.
Can you explain how smoking marijuana made you feel distant from them and how marijuana was different than beer in your life
just,
and theirs?
Yes, I think alcohol is a depressive drug, whereas marijuana is not. I never got depressed when I smoked dope at all. It was only a joyful experience, and I'm not condoning, you know, my drug use. But at that time, smoking dope wasn't that big a deal, and I quite frankly, I loved it. It expanded my mind. It made me think about more profound issues. The Hollies were good at creating, you know, a 2.5-minute pop song, you know, to be played right before the news, you know, kind of moon, June, me in the back of the car kind of lyrics. And then I, you know, in hanging out with David and Stephen and Neil and Joni, I began to realize that you could write catchy melodies that would attract people, but you could talk about real things. And I began to change the way I wrote songs. I was trained to write good pop songs, and I took that sensibility and talked about what I considered to be deeper, more profound subjects.
You became Joni Mitchell's lover, and her former lover was your bandmate David Crosby. So,
correct. Yes.
That must have been a little bit awkward, maybe, or maybe not.
No, not at all. Wasn't awkward at all.
Why wasn't it awkward?
Because, you know, David had finished his relationship with Joan. And he always told me that if I ever meet, you know, this woman, Joni Mitchell, you know, go and say hello because I've spoken to her about you. This is David talking. And that, in fact, happened in when the Hollies played in Ottawa in Canada in I think, late 66 or early 67. After the show, the promoter throws the usual party where you're standing there with a plastic glass of awful wine and you're trying to, you know, smile at everybody. And I saw this blonde in the corner. And she was incredibly attractive. And my manager was nattering in my ear about whatever it was, you know, the promoter and his wife's name, and say hello to Georgie and all that kind of stuff. And I say, look, stop talking to me. I'm trying to attract this woman. And he said, well, if you'll just listen, I was trying to tell you that her name is Joni Mitchell and she wants to meet you. And that's how I met Joan.
And then it was at Joni Mitchell's house that you first sang with David Crosby and Stephen Stills. Tell the story.
I'd traveled from London to Los Angeles to be with Joni for a few days. When I approached the house, it was obvious that there were other people there, which kind of made me a little hesitant. Anyway, I went in, and it was David and Stephen. And I'd met them before. You know, Cass Elliot, our dear friend, had introduced me to Crosby, and Crosby, of course, had introduced me to Stephen. And then we parted ways because I was still in the Hollies and had to go back to England. But this particular night in Joni's living room, David said to Stephen, hey, play Willie, that song that we just were working on.
Willie is your nickname.
Yes, my name is Graham William Nash, yes. And so they sang this beautiful song that Stephen had written called You Don't Have to Cry, which was on the first CSN record. And they got to the end of it, and I complimented Stephen on writing a beautiful song. And I said, do me a favor, sing it one more time. And they sang it again. And I said, okay, bear with me. One more time. Whatever vocal sound that Crosby, Stills, and Nash has was born in less than 40 seconds. No rehearsing, no months' rehearsals, no years of rehearsing to get that vocal blend. It happened instantly, and we all knew it. So much that we all actually stopped singing the song and started to laugh because it was silly. I mean, the Hollies and the Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds were great harmony bands, you know. We knew what we were doing. But this was completely different. This was a vocal sound that we'd never heard before. And I knew at that moment that I would have to go back to England and virtually undo my entire life.
Now, did you sing the same way, the same harmony on the recording of You Don't Have to Cry, which is the song that you first sang with them at Joni Mitchell's house?
Exactly the same.
And why don't we hear some of that? This is Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
In the morning when you rise, do you think of me and how you left me crying? Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality I left years ago, it quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy, old before your time. And the difference between me and you, I won't argue right or wrong, but I have time to cry, my baby.
I want to play one other song, and I want to play a song you wrote, which is Our House. And this actually comes out of an actual...
Well, it's an ordinary moment. What happened is that Joni and I don't know whether you know anything about Los Angeles, but on Ventura Boulevard in the Valley, there's a very famous deli called Art's Deli. And we'd been to breakfast there. We're going to get into Joan's car, and we pass an antique store, and we're looking in the window, and she saw a very beautiful vase that she wanted to buy.
I should say, for anyone just tuning in, it's Joni Mitchell that Graham Nash was talking
yes.
about. Go ahead.
Yeah, excuse me. So Joni and I were looking in the window. I persuaded her to buy this vase. It wasn't very expensive. And we took it home. It was a very gray kind of sleety, drizzly L.A. morning. And we got to the house in Laurel Canyon, and I said, got through the front door, and I said, you know what? I'll light a fire. Why don't you put some flowers in that vase that you just bought? Well, she was in the garden getting flowers. That meant she was not at her piano, but I was. And an hour later, our house was born out of an incredibly ordinary moment that many, many people have experienced.
So talk about the harmonies on this recording.
It's me and David and Stephen doing our best. That's all we ever do. You know, we're lucky enough to be able to do, you know, anything that we want to do musically. And, you know, these two guys are incredible musicians. Crosby is one of the most unique musicians I know. And Stephen Stills has got this blues-based South American kind of feeling to his music. And I'm this, you know, Henry VIII guy from England. You know, it's not not supposed to work, but it does somehow.
Okay, this is Our House, and this is Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long. Call me, only for me. Come to me now, to me, rest your head for just 5 minutes. Everything is done. Such a cozy room, such a cozy. The windows are illuminated by the evening sunshine through them, fiery gems. So hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. And la, 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 la.
That's Crosby, Stills, and Nash singing the Graham Nash song, Our House. Graham Nash is my guest. He has a new memoir, which is called Wild Tales. So at some point, Neil Young joins the group. And you objected to it. You didn't want him to join. Why not?
We had just created a very unique three-part vocal sound. And we already had that first record. But what happened is this. Stephen, the musician that he is, played almost every instrument on that first record, apart from the drums, which was Dallas Taylor. Of course, Crosby and I played rhythm on, you know, Crosby played on Guinevere, I played on Lady of the Island, etc. But the bass and the B3 organ and the piano was all Stephen. Now we know that we're going to have to go out and play live because we feel that we have a hit record in our hands. But what do you do? And I felt that we needed another musician because Stephen can't play he can't play bass and B3 and lead guitar at the same time, obviously. So I think that Stephen and Dallas had gone to England. They asked various people to if they were interested in joining us, including Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Winwood, but they all already had their own careers going. So at dinner in New York, David and Stephen had dinner with Ahmet Erdogan, who was the owner and president of Atlantic Records. And it was Ahmet that said to Stephen, you know, I know who you should get, man. I know exactly who you should get. You should get Neil Young back. Now, please understand that Stephen had just gone through 2 years of madness with Neil, you know, not trusting him to turn up, not, you know. In the Buffalo Springfield. And was very reluctant to do that. But he understood that Ahmet understood that what Stephen and Neil brought in terms of their guitar playing against each other and with each other was something phenomenal, that if that was brought to Crosby, Stills, and Nash, we would have something really, really unique. But I'd never met Neil. I knew he was a fine writer. But I didn't know whether I could hang out with him. I didn't know whether I could be his friend. And so I said, you know, before we make this kind of momentous decision here, because as you realize, four-part harmony is very different than three-part, I said, I need to meet Neil. So I had breakfast with Neil on Bleecker Street in New York City. And quite frankly, after that breakfast, I would have made him Prime Minister of Canada. The guy was incredibly funny, and he was very self-assured, and he knew exactly what he wanted. And I said, you know, so why do we want you in the band? I mean, we're great as we are. I mean, we thought we were great, you know. Why do we need you? And he looked at me and he said, you ever heard me and Stephen play guitar together, man? And I knew from that moment that we needed to have Neil join.
How did it change the harmonies?
It's more difficult to produce, to sing four part. You know, you've got to start shifting parts around and stuff. Neil brings a darker edge to our music. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a, you know, it's more intense, you know. And that first album of Crosby, Stills and Nash is kind of summery, kind of lots of palm trees in it, you know, feeling, you know, a cool breeze through the canyons kind of music. Actually, Jimi Hendrix, when asked what he thought of Crosby, Stills and Nash, looked at the interview and said, that's Western sky music. And I thought, wow, that's brilliant. Anyway, the point is that Neil brings a different kind of musical intensity to the band, and the music of Crosby, Stills and Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young is very, very different.
In the acknowledgments to your book, where you're praising your friends and your family, you describe Neil Young as, quote, the strangest of my friends.
He is.
What makes him strange?
The man is totally committed to the muse of music, and he'll do anything for good music. And sometimes it's very strange. I was at Neil's ranch one day, just south of San Francisco, and he has a beautiful lake with red-winged blackbirds, and he asked me if I wanted to hear his new album, Harvest, and I said, sure, let's go into the studio and listen. Oh, no, that's not what Neil had in mind. He said, get into the rowboat. I said, get into the rowboat. He said, yeah, we're going to go out into the middle of the lake. Now, I think he's got a little cassette player with him or a little, you know, early digital format player, you know, so I'm thinking I'm going to wear headphones and listen in the relative peace of the middle of Neil's lake. Oh, no. He has his entire house as the left speaker and his entire barn as the right speaker. And I heard Harvest coming out of these two incredibly large speakers louder than hell. It was unbelievable. Elliot Mazer, who produced Neil, Harvest, came down to the shore of the lake and he shouted out to Neil, how was that, Neil? And I swear to God, Neil Young shouted back, more barn. Neil is a very strange cat.
You know, in your memoir, you write about how you were all doing cocaine and while you were recording Helpless, Crosby, mm-hmm. Stills, Nash and Young, you had to wait till the cocaine started to wear off because you were just going too fast
too
from
fast.
The cocaine to sing a slow song
a very
like
slow,
Helpless.
Yeah, that's right. So Neil wasn't a particularly drug user, and we had to. I think we recorded Helpless something like 2:30 in the morning when we finally had come down enough to play at the speed that Neil wanted for his song Helpless. But we made it. It's a fine track.
When you realize that as much cocaine as everybody was doing, that David Crosby had like a really serious drug problem, like a life-threatening drug problem. Mm.
Yes, he did.
What did you think to yourself about what you could or couldn't do to try to intervene to save him? I think that's always really hard when you have somebody who you know is headed for trouble, but there's a limit to what you can do to stop
him. What happened in this particular case is that David and I, had, from the very beginning of our relationships, always wanted to be winners. We wanted to be victors. We didn't want to be victims. of rock and roll madness. And we swore to each other that we would never be in a position where we couldn't, you know, pick up the phone and book a studio and book engineers and musicians and tape and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's what we think is winning in this business. If you don't have the availability to use the tools of your trade, then you're already behind the eight ball. So I saw my friend, you know, losing it completely. I mean, he was losing it to the point when he couldn't even sing and he couldn't write and he was depressed all the time. And one particular incident, we were recording in Los Angeles and his Freebase pipe was on the amplifier. And normally what happens in, you know, to warm up a band, you know, you just, somebody starts playing a groove and the piano player starts playing and the bass player does and the guitar player and we all start to jam, you know. And we were in the middle of an incredible jam. It was sounding incredible. But what was happening is that the amplifier was shaking because of the, you know, the energy in the jam. And slowly but surely, the Freebase pipe was heading towards the end of the amp, and it fell off at one point and smashed on the floor. And David stopped the jam. He stopped us playing. And that was the point when I realized that I'd had it, that I couldn't do this anymore. Because we were supposed to win. We weren't supposed to be losing. And so, it was a very dark time for me because my best friend, David, was completely losing it, and I seemed to be powerless, you know? Yeah, sad.
So what did you try to do?
I tried taking as many drugs as David, or more drugs. I tried to be out there with him.
Why would that have been helpful to take more drugs than him?
I don't know, but that's what happened, you know. And I mean, I wasn't that sane myself at the time, you know, because, like I said, you know, we were all, you know, very high at most of the time.
Did you think you'd be safer? He'd be safer if you accompanied him by doing.
Yes, I did. I felt that if he felt that I was with him, that it would be a great help, you know, because what can you do? We were so high. A lot of people ask us if we'd have made better music or if we'd have made more music if we were straight. But I'll never know the answer to that question because it was what it was. Mm-hmm. And even today, it is what it is. You know, we've obviously stopped the drug taking many years ago. And the older we get, the more that we tend to concentrate on our strengths and not our weaknesses. And personally, I think that we're better now than we've ever been.
Graham Nash has a new memoir called Wild Tales, A Rock and Roll Life. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we'll listen to Terry's interview with Billy Crystal. But first, let's hear a little bit of the song Graham Nash was talking about the band recording around 2:30 in the morning as the cocaine wore off, Neil Young's Helpless.
There is a town in North Ontario. Dream comfort memory to spare, and in my mind I still need a place to go. All my changes were there. Blue windows behind the stars.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Billy Crystal, has written a new memoir called Still Foolin' 'Em, which finds him looking back on his life after turning 65. His autobiographical one-man show, 700 Sundays, which won a Tony in 2005, reopens on Broadway next month. Billy Crystal got his start doing stand-up. In 1977, he landed a leading role in the TV series Soap, playing one of the first openly gay characters on television. In 1984, he joined the cast of Saturday Night Live. Billy Crystal has starred in the films When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, and Analyze This, and he's hosted the Oscars more times than anyone except Bob Hope. He spoke with Terry earlier this week.
Billy Crystal, welcome to Fresh Air. So you turned 65 in March, and you talk about growing up around older complaining people. What were some of their favorite complaints?
Well, I mean, the original title of this book was Everything Hurts. And that was pretty much them. Everything hurts. It was just, it was like walking into the Mayo Clinic with phlegm. Basically, it was just a Mayo Clinic with phlegm. That was them. And it was always, everyone was always not well. And I think a way to combat my fear of what would eventually happen to me, I would imitate them and make jokes about them. And so I think there was a way to make it a little easier.
When you were doing stand-up in the era before you were on Saturday Night Live, you opened for Sammy Davis Jr. at Harris in Tahoe.
Yes.
And you tell this hysterical story. You know, one of the things Sammy Davis Jr. was always famous for was saying about everybody that they were a great humanitarian and that they're such a wonderful person. He really loved them. And he kind of did that for you. But tell a story.
Well, first of all, I love this guy. I thought that Sammy Davis Jr.
Don't go sounding like Sammy and talking about him.
No, I know. I know. No, and I mean that. This is one of the ultimate cats. He was so extraordinary, you know, in his height when, you know, we would grow up and watch. And my uncle produced his first gold record, which was a song called Hey There from the Pajama Game.
Was it your Uncle Milt Gabler?
And yes. My Uncle Milt Gabler was a gigantic force in the music industry, Grammy Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, produces Rock Around the Clock and all the Billie Holiday's great things and so on. So he kept telling me about Sammy Davis Jr. Watch him. He does all these great things. So now I get a chance to open for him. And I was in a good groove, you know, was where I was. And now I get a chance to do 28 straight nights with Sammy Davis Jr. at a fantastic nightclub in a hotel in Tahoe. And we meet. I got to say, it's thrilling. There he is. I mean, he's an iconic figure. And I do 30 minutes on the button. I finish, get a great hand from the audience. I walk off in the wings, feeling really good about myself. Sammy just walks out behind me. He's not even introduced. The band plays him on. He just follows me right out. He says to the audience, "Isn't he an extraordinary young man? Let me tell you something about this cat. Last year, when I was so sick and had pneumonia in Reno, young Bill comes to the hospital, holds up a sign that says, 'Get well, Sam, can't headline without you.' That's the kind of man this kid is. Big hand, big hand. It never happened."
I love that.
Second show, same night. I do my thing. Again, everything goes great. Go on the wings. Sammy walks out. "Is that the White Prior or am I nuts?" He goes on and on and on, tells this other story. And now I'm going, this is like a little crazy. I go to the sound booth. I say to the guy, I said, "Would you record all of Sammy's intros?" He goes, "Yeah, because that was really sweet what you did for him at going to the hospital." I said, "Yeah, well, yeah. Well, you know, that's who I am." He records all of Sammy's intros. Terry, I have 40-something intros. All are different. None of them happened. And it was hilarious. I had Bill's daughters on the lake today and were skipping stones, you know, throwing rocks and watching the... You know, watching how the ripples go, and, you know, they're asking me, say, "Uncle Sam, how does that happen?" They love to call me Uncle Sam. Never happened. It never happened.
Why did he do that?
Because it was show business. I think he thought he was doing a good thing for me and for him. He created this whole wonderful fantasy world for the two of us that was part of the show. And I was okay with it. I thought it was really fascinating. So closing night, Sammy never used to watch me. He would come down just at the last second, but he would always listen to my show in his dressing room. And I come out on stage, it's closing night, and I'm actually sorry that it's ending because I had a blast. It was sold-out crowds every night. I'd come down early, meet Sammy in the dressing room. We'd talk about all kinds of stuff. He'd tell me these amazing stories. And that's how I started to imitate him, because when you're in the room with him and you're just playing backgammon or just hanging out, you can't not want to sound like him while you're talking to him. And that's exciting. And it was so great. So I come out and I hear him as I'm greeting the audience. I hear him stamping and laughing in the wings. And I look over and there he is, and he's pointing to the monitor, which is in front of me, which was, he had two sound monitors and one that was a crawl that had the lyrics of the songs in case he forgot the lyrics of the songs. So it was working on a videotape crawl, a prompter. So I'm looking at it, and it's a porno movie. I mean, a really rough porno movie. And it played the whole 30 minutes that I'm on, and it was really rough going. It was hilarious, and that was sort of his rap present for me, was to do that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Billy Crystal, and he has a new best-selling memoir called Still Foolin' 'Em. So somebody else who you used to do on Saturday Night Live was Fernando Lamas, and your impression of him originated as a telephone prank.
Yes. Yeah, a lot
First
of my
First of all,
voices
you need to go back for people who don't remember who Fernando Lamas was.
Fernando Lamas was a, I'm going to say it respectfully, a B actor in a good way, because he was very good, Latin, very handsome leading man who was married to Esther Williams. And I would watch Fernando Lamas on a Tonight Show with Johnny. And they would just talk about women and things, and I just thought he was like the coolest guy, but very ripe for parody. So one day I called my manager, David Steinberg, who is a very funny guy, and I called his office, and his assistant got on the phone, and I said, "Hello, this is Fernando Lamas. I'd like to talk to David Steinberg, please." And she went, "What is it in reference to?" "He'll know what it's a reference to, darling. This is Fernando Lamas." She had no idea it was me. And David gets on, "Hello." "Hello, Dave. You know..." And now as soon as I did that, he knows it's me. And he starts feeding me, because he's a very good improviser. And he starts going, "So where are you?" "I'm in Del Rey. I like to go to the races. Esther and I like to go." "How is Esther?" "She looks marvelous." And that's how it started. So now I started calling him all the time. Now he would call me, and then other managers would start calling me, and then my friends would call me. It got around, so it became like this wildfire thing, and that's how it really started.
So, you know, really, like, you're from a showbiz industry, even though your parents were in performers, but, you know, your uncle, Milt Gabler, was the founder of, really, like, the first independent jazz label in the country, Commodore Records, in the 1930s.
Right.
Then he moved to Decca. He produced Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit because her own recording company thought it was too political. It's a song about hangings,
right.
about lynching.
Yeah, and you know, that was it's almost 75 years ago now, and he stood up for the right thing, and my family always stood up for the right thing. I mean, the fact that I was raised the way I was. If you were at my bar mitzvah, and I'm sorry you didn't get the invitation.
It must have gotten lost in the mail. Yeah.
Well, it's the shutdown. The mail was terrible.
Yeah.
It was a jam session. The party became a jam session. And, you know, if you're doing one of the horrors and you're holding hands with Tyree Glenn and Willie the Lion Smith, I mean, we just didn't blink. That was the house, you know. And so Milt was a huge influence in the jazz world. You know, all of Billie's stuff. He actually wrote Fine and Mellow with her.
Which was the flip side of Strange Fruit and was a very successful song.
Yeah, so... Yeah.
I'm going to stop right here because I actually want to play for you and for our listeners a very short excerpt of a 1979 interview I did with your uncle, Milt Gabler.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know, because I love all the stuff you recorded on Commodore. And so, we were talking about recording Billie Holiday, and he told this really nice story about getting her to record Lover Man. It was before anybody really knew the song, apparently. So this is my guest, Billy Crystal's uncle, Milt Gabler, recorded in 1979, and I should say he died at the age of 90 in 2001. So I had asked him here about working with Billie Holiday, and he told the story about getting her to record Lover Man.
I used to always stop into Jimmy Ryan's to say hello and have a drink. and there was a club next door. Forget the name of it. That's not important. I had my drink, and Billy went on next door, and I went into the room, and she was singing Lover Man. And I said, my God, that's a natural smash hit. I don't know if you know what a natural hit is. During the year, when you're a record producer, an A&R man working for a record company, if you find two natural hits in one year, a natural hit is a song that you almost cannot destroy. And no matter who you give it to, it becomes a hit. If you sing it going up in the elevator man says, gee, that's a great tune. You know, that's a natural. So I walk in, and she's singing Lover Man, and anybody would know that's a hit. So I said, God, I got to record that immediately before someone steals it from her, some other singer. And it became a standard immediately.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling
wow. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. So
I haven't heard his voice in a long time. That's great. That's a real treat. He was a giant for me.
Oh, I can see why. And he sounds so much of an era.
Yes, he was. And he created an era. When Milt produced records, we became very close. He's my mom's big brother, and he always looked at me with, because he knew I had that little bit of the shine in my eye that this is what I wanted to do, and so as we got closer after my dad died, Milt really took me under his wing a lot, and I'd go to sessions. See Louis Armstrong. He produced Louis Armstrong. I'd see Ella Fitzgerald. You know, I was around it was fantastic how we would place the microphones in the room so the guys could look at each other and play with each other, and solo with each other, and instead of being in separate places. And he worked out these balances on the keyboard and how to mix, really starting from scratch. It wasn't his thing. He just sort of said, I want to do this. And that's why the original Commodores are so still collector's items, because they have this unique sound. But Milt had a sound to me, which I hear in that interview. You can hear the excitement he had, the love that he had for the artists and the material. And I was very fortunate to be his nephew.
Early in your career, years before you got on Saturday Night Live, you did the sitcom Soap, in which you played the first gay character to be a leading role in a TV series. How did you decide how to play him so it wouldn't be an offensive stereotype?
It was hard because I think in the beginning.
And I ask that because there were so many gay characters depicted in popular culture at the time who were kind of offensive stereotypes.
Yeah, and we, I think in the beginning we did offend some people, because the first appearance of his name was Jody Dallas. The first big scene that he had, he was in his mother's clothes and a wig. He was dressing up, and it was a hilarious scene. She walked in on him and started screaming, "Take off my dress!" And then she suddenly stopped and went, "Oh, you wear it belted." Oh, it looks much better belted. And then we have a discussion about the dress. And it was a brilliant actress named Catherine Damon who played my mother. And we just decided, and one of the reasons I decided to do the show was because we could depict this man as a man who just happened to be gay. That's who he was. Now, this is 1977, Terry. You know, as I look back, there were so many difficult scenes to do because we were in front of a live audience. And I'd be acting with the man who was playing my lover, and we used those words, and the audience would titter and laugh and make me uncomfortable in doing the scenes where I wanted to stop and yell at them. What's so funny? What's the matter with you people? Grow up! I mean, it made me very self-conscious at times, and I think it was in the third season. Jody was confused about his sexuality, and he has a one-night stand with a woman, and she gets pregnant and has a baby. And that was my storyline, in the soap opera, which Soap was, of course. Now I have to raise this with this little girl. And so we go to court, who's going to get custody of the child. And ABC did a poll, and at the poll at that time, it said 3-1 that the country wanted Jody to get the baby. And I thought, okay, we did good here.
So one of the things you're famous for is having hosted the Oscars more times than anybody except for Bob Hope. So is that 8 times or 9 times?
9.
9 times.
I've done it 9 times, yeah.
I know that one of the things you did when you were hosting the Oscars is, you know, come up with new lines in response to things that had happened during the ceremony. So, like, during a commercial break or during someone's, like, acceptance speech, you're backstage with one of the other writers maybe, you know, coming up with stuff working off of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That strikes me as so risky because, first of all, like, literally the world is watching.
Yes.
And you don't have time to test it. It's not like, I mean, you're going to try it out in a small
club.
And
that's the Terry. That's the job. That's why, you know, that's why I love doing it because I love the danger of it. And you have to come through. For me, you know, my finest moment ever, maybe as a comedian, I was introducing Hal Roach. Mr. Roach was 100 years old. He was one of the fathers of early days in films. He put Laurel with Hardy. He created the Our Gang Kids. And all these silent movies he did. He was a giant. And he was just supposed to take a bow. So I'm at center stage, and I go, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Hal Roach. Big hand, he stands up, and he starts talking. And he has no microphone. And from the stage, it sounded like this. Thank you very much, Billy. You know, when I like about all the people, and I can see Laurel and Hardy and Babe, oh, Babe and Alfalfa, and God. And it's getting restless in the audience. And they're all looking at me going, what are you going to say? And I see the red lights right on me. And I looked at the audience and, you know, lines are flying through my head. And then one settled like a slot machine, 3 cherries, boom, 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 boom. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, it's only fitting because he got his start in silent films. And it just
took the
pressure away. It you know, and that's one time I will pat myself on the back, and I will sound like Sammy to myself and say, that was good. You handled that one good, pal. Yeah, I was proud of that moment.
Billy Crystal's new memoir is called Still Foolin' 'Em. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. Thank you.